From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on June 22nd when Monroe County saw its lowest number of local coronavirus cases since the end of March. That day, the second official day of summer, only 6 new cases were reported locally. Throughout much of the summer, the number stayed relatively low. Many weeks averaged only about a dozen new cases per day. And while the rest of the country struggled to bring the case numbers down, our county had become kind of a national model. Now, that seems so long ago, not because we're doing poorly singularly, but it's a struggle. This week, we saw 315 cases in a single day, a new local record, and more than 50 times the number of daily cases we saw on the low end in June. Yesterday, we were back under 200, and we hope that our community is already making changes to bend that curve back down. Schools and most businesses remain open, albeit with some restrictions. Nobody wants to change that. In fact, contrary to the narrative that some have spread, I can tell you that local government and health leaders have been meeting constantly in recent weeks, often privately, with the goal of finding a way to keep things open for as long as possible. But that's only possible if we are protecting lives successfully. Thanksgiving is in 8 days. CBS News reports that we can learn from Canada, who already had their Thanksgiving on October 12th. 2 weeks after Canadian Thanksgiving, COVID cases had risen by more than 20% in Canada. If that happens in this country, we will pass 200,000 cases in a single day as a country for the first time. My guest this hour is the Monroe County Commissioner of Public Health, Dr. Michael Mendoza, who has been helping guide this ship through the storm this year, and we've got a lot to talk about now. Dr. Mendoza, always good to have you. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan. Good afternoon. Good to be here.
How do you see things going locally for the moment?
Well, you know what? Yesterday looked like it was an inflection point. Our numbers were a little lower, which, you know, daily totals can fluctuate a little bit, but when you look at the 7-day total as of yesterday, things were turning in the right direction. So I am seeing a glimmer of hope, but that is a bit guarded because of Thanksgiving, and I'm sure we'll get into that. But for now, I think there is reason to be hopeful.
Okay. I assume that, you know, everybody wants more data, bigger sample sizes, but how many days in a row do you need to see the numbers, you know, either tracking down or not kind of pushing up, up, up before you start to say, hey, maybe we've made an impact here?
Well, certainly the more the better. When we look at a 7-day average, that's reassuring. I think a 14-day trend is better because the incubation period is 14 days. Mm-hmm. And I think any time we make a change in our behavior individually or collectively, we really don't see the impact of that for at least a week or two. But the reality is that you really can't look at any single figure in all of the data that are available that gives us a true pulse on how we're doing. And that's what makes it so difficult. Everybody wants to look at one number and say, that's how many touchdowns that we've scored today, and that's how we know we're winning. And the reality is that we don't have that in a pandemic.
Let me talk to you a little bit about schools. I know it's important to a lot of families, a lot of parents. Most districts, with the exception of the Rochester City School District, have kids in physical classrooms at least several days a week. And I know you said that that is an important goal for the community to try to achieve as long as it's being done safely. What have we Absolutely. Learned? What have we learned since September, and where are you on that now?
Well, before September, we really didn't know. And we went through a whole lot of planning because we just did not know what things would look like. And, you know, back then we had seen reports even from Atlanta and other places down south that were raising a lot of eyebrows here in our community. And so we worked very closely with the school districts, the publics, the privates, the charters, and that work had begun in March when things began to close down. And looking back, that was a fortuitous effort because without those relationships, my meeting weekly with the superintendents and leadership of the schools, I don't think we would have gotten to where we got to in September. But since September, we learned that the numbers did not increase as we had feared. And that was a very good thing. And, you know, until very recently, frankly, I wasn't sure if the low numbers were because of all of the precautions that everybody had taken in the schools or if it was truly because there wasn't much COVID there to transmit. So that was where we were as of this past weekend. And so with all of the attention around testing, and we'll get into that too, I'm sure, so far so good. We've learned that there has been exceedingly few cases of asymptomatic carriage in our schools. So I think that is very reassuring as we go forward as well.
Yeah, Overall, would you say it's gone as well as it probably could have, given all of the question marks we did have going into September?
Yes, I do. I think we have learned a lot. I think we have proven now. You know, I don't know that we needed the testing effort that we undertook this past week to know that, but we now know that. I think we can proceed with pretty good confidence that the schools are, in fact, very safe. Now, that is all in the context of how we're doing as a community, because, you know, it doesn't take long for a community case to find its way into the schools, and I think all the precautions in place have decreased the probability of that. But it really does rely on parents and students and teachers to keep doing what they're doing. And, you know, we've spoken a lot about pandemic fatigue, and I think anybody is susceptible to that. So we have to keep our guard up if we want to keep our schools open.
What's your message to parents who have been really upset about some kids getting tested?
I understand. You know, as a parent, I only want what's best for my children's health and safety. And when there's uncertainty, as a parent, our job is to put up our guard. You know, that's what we do as parents. We're there to make sure we protect our kids. So I get it. And I went through a lot of effort over the weekend working with schools and with my team to try to offer as best of a picture of what we know about this test going into this week. And I've long said that parents have the right to opt out. I do not want parents to feel forced into testing. But by the same token, this test is not a big deal when it comes down to it. We've had thousands of kids get tested, and we've had no complaints from those who've gotten tested. So I appreciate the concerns of people who wish to opt out. I respect that. But I also think that, you know, this test, it really wasn't as big a deal as it was made out to be, and we should have done more ahead of time to prepare the public for it.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And you shot a video of yourself kind of giving yourself a little test there. Look, you know, like no problem. And, you know, one of the things I saw people asking after they saw the video and asking in advance of your appearance on the program today is, are the swabs any shorter these days?
You know, the swabs aren't any shorter, but you don't really need more than a couple inches of it. So the swab that goes in for this particular test is it only goes in about an inch for an adult, and it goes in even less than that for a child. So it truly isn't that invasive at all.
Yeah, I've been saying that. I mean, I kind of was laughing with a restaurant owner yesterday who she said she's looking forward to the spit tests. And I said, you know, I know, but like, I think we should all be really, really thankful that these tests exist at all and that we're turning them around the way they are. I have felt tremendously fortunate since I started getting tested in, I think it was in May, that this community is doing what it's doing out at MCC and across the state.
Indeed.
And so let's talk a little bit about where the future of testing is going here. We continue to see the nasal swabs. There's still some talk and uncertainty about if saliva tests could be possible, if more rapid testing in different forms could be possible. How do you see the next maybe month to couple months as we move throughout the winter in testing?
Well, you know, we're entering a period where demand for testing is increasing. And I think that's the right problem to have. That's a good problem. And it is a challenge because as more people get tested, because we have more cases and more contacts and so forth, it is going to start to place a demand on our system. The healthcare systems have committed to testing symptomatic individuals, which means that asymptomatic people are now in a position where they're having to look a little more difficult, you know, a little harder to find those tests. And MCC is becoming a challenge as well because we are very quickly starting to max out on their capacity. So this is something that we need to look into. But, you know, the other point I'd like to make about testing is that ever since the beginning, I've always wanted to caution people that we don't want to derive a false sense of security from a negative test because none of these tests is perfect. Even the gold standard PCR test with a nasopharyngeal specimen, you know, if you test negative today, that doesn't mean an exposure yesterday isn't going to cause you to have an infection tomorrow. And so until we have a vaccine and better certainty, I think we need to continue to look at our precautions, our masking, our gathering, our distancing as the way we achieve herd protection, if you will.
Yeah, and so I'm going to get right back to testing in a moment. Let me close the loop on schools. Is there Is there a standard in your mind that would lead you to say, hey, my recommendation is now is the time to go full remote? Doesn't sound like we've really moved in that direction, given what we are learning about transmission or not in schools. But is there a line that is pretty firm for you?
It's not a number, I'll tell you that. I mean, okay. I had been thinking back in late October when our numbers were so good that I would like to start to pilot opening some schools then. And what it would take is, unfortunately, twice the square footage and twice the educators. And that is a tall order. So would there have been ways to expand the footprint, the physical plant of schools in some way? Because I think schools figured it out. The hardest part about schools is that what they did to achieve the distancing was to cut the class sizes in half, which is a hard one to overcome. But I think from the standpoint of all the procedures and everything that they had done with the people in the buildings, you know, I think we're really close to trying to figure that out. But I think the biggest hurdle is that distancing part. And I haven't found a substitute for 6 feet yet. And that is the main challenge in my mind at this point.
Okay, but it doesn't sound like there's really anything in the offing that would lead you to kind of reverse course and say, now's the time to close schools and go forward.
Oh, closing schools. I think if the community prevalence rate really started to launch, if we started to trace more cases into teachers or into classrooms, I would be very, very cautious.
But that's not happening now, yeah.
It's currently not happening,
yeah.
And we have a good data set from earlier this week to confirm that. So we certainly want to continue watching, but until that happens, I think, you know, we're full steam ahead with trying to keep schools open for sure.
Now, when it comes to the increased demand for testing, as you point out, a lot of that comes from people who are thinking about getting tested for Thanksgiving, and if they get a negative test, maybe they get together. First of all, in general, do you think that line of thinking is a wise one, that, hey, I'm going to get tested a few days out, I'll lock it down for a few days, the test result will come back. If it's good, I'm going to go home and see mom and dad?
You know, I think it's reasonable, but I think the risks of that approach outweigh the benefits. I think there are far more ways for that to go wrong than for it to go right. It's certainly better than nothing. I think it's better than not testing at all. But I don't think a negative test is a green light to double your party size and take your mask off. So I think we have to be very careful about that. And quite frankly, there's still so much about transmission indoors that we don't know. And a lot of experience that we have gleaned from the Canadian experience from Halloween here locally. You know, Halloween hurt. I think Halloween is the reason we saw this more recent uptick in our cases. And, you know, you could say that we're out of the shadow now of Halloween, but we're looking ahead to Thanksgiving. And Thanksgiving is going to be orders of magnitude more problematic from a gathering standpoint, in my view, than Halloween. So I would rather people, you know, stick to what we've been doing. And now is not the time to start to be a hero and try to test our way through this. You know, I think we stick to the basics, wear our masks, keep our distance, and really be thoughtful about keeping that gathering size as small as necessary.
Yeah, and I was thinking about college kids coming home and saw a colleague, Berkeley Breen, among others, reporting on this and doing really important work, I think, to kind of understand the approach that, first of all, students are having, campuses. And I know for some, it doesn't feel like there's an option. But it strikes me, tell me if I'm wrong here, Dr. Mendoza, it strikes me that when we think about our pods, our family pods, if you have kids in college, they are not really in your bubble. They're living if they're living at college.
That's true. You know, the pod is it's really a theoretical concept. But in practice, you know, everybody in a pod has a different pod that, you know, they may interact with. So I have a pod with my family, but then I have a pod here at work, and then everybody here at work has their own pod with their family and so on. So it's a nice model, but in practice, it doesn't totally work, you know, in today's day and age. So I think we have to be very careful about that. And, you know, I was in touch with a number of the colleges as they were thinking about going remote and sending their students back for a Thanksgiving holiday and so forth. And, you know, when you've got somebody under quarantine on campus, you know, it's a risk and a benefit. Do we keep them on campus, or do we send them home to their family? And neither option is ideal. So, you know, we're dealing with balancing choices, of which neither is risk-free. And so I think we have to be very careful, particularly as we invite our college students back home for the holidays.
Yeah, and I don't hear you saying don't do it or don't get together. I hear you essentially advising the community on a sliding scale of risk. Is that fair?
Yes, yes. I'm not going to tell people, that they can or cannot have a holiday. I think that overly simplifies a very complicated decision. And frankly, I think people are smart enough to know that life is not black and white like that. But I'm certainly not saying, open the doors and have a free-for-all. That would be very unwise. I do want people to be very, very careful, because at the end of the day, we hold our future in our own hands and in our gatherings that we may or may not have at Thanksgiving. And the last thing I want to do is tax our healthcare system, and that is where we're heading. And so we have to be very careful about Thanksgiving. And for my family, we're going to keep it to 4, and that would be a first for us. But, as I see it, it is a small price that we can pay. And I don't know that other families feel the same way, but I would encourage people to really dig deep and ask themselves if they really need to have that large gathering or whether it can be made a little bit smaller for this year.
How do you like the idea of everyone who is going to bring different dishes still makes the dishes? You find a driveway that's sort of a meeting point. You divide up food. You take it back to your own houses and you Zoom with the food.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. Any way that we can keep that gathering, physical gathering, down to a minimum while maintaining that social connection, I think that's very reasonable. I mean, I don't think anybody knows how to have Thanksgiving on a Zoom. That would be a first for probably every family that I can think of. But if that works, go for it. I've seen a lot of creativity. When we looked at Halloween, I was so inspired by the creativity that homeowners and trick-or-treaters demonstrated. And I think our community can come together and figure out ways to be creative while being safe at the same time.
Listeners, I know you've got questions. We'll be getting those in just a moment for Dr. Michael Mendoza, the Commissioner of Public Health from Monroe County. I want to work through a couple of other things. First, when you mentioned the demand on the testing system locally, do you think people who are not symptomatic and don't have a reason to think they've been exposed should decide not to get tested right now to help with the demand and the strain on the system? Or is it a case where, the governors continue to say, get tested, get tested, get tested? Where's your mindset on this?
Right now I want to encourage anybody who's got a question to get tested. And when we have data that show that we're really heading into a crunch with the test supplies, then I'll reevaluate that. But, until then, I want to encourage people to get tested. And, I would rather have the problem of trying to create more capacity than to have the problem of having capacity that's going unused. My job is to try to work to bring that capacity to our community, and I want to have that challenge. So to those who are wondering, get tested.
I want to stress another point about businesses as we think about restaurants, bars, we think about retail shops. I know there have been some meetings that have happened often via Zoom or conference, et cetera, among local leaders in government. I bring that up to listeners because some of those have been private and for good reason. There's still some questions about what policy is going to be going forward. But I bring it up because for those who have this idea that since the start of the pandemic, some people just want to close everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, elected leaders who are Republicans and Democrats and otherwise mm-hmm. have a goal, and I'm just stressing to the community, people want to do everything possible to keep everything
yep.
open to the extent
yep.
that it is safe. And I hear about that, and I don't know how much you can talk about that, but can you take me through the mindset that you've experienced when you talk to government leaders, when you talk to business leaders about what's being done to give them a chance to handle this economically?
Yeah, let's just look at it on the face of it. If we didn't want to keep things open, it would be so much easier just to close it all down. I mean, truly. The reason, and when it comes to schools, that was very public. The reason we worked through the weekend and all the long hours of the last week just on schools was to give them every chance possible so that we didn't have a reason to close. That very simply, it would have been so much easier. And other counterparts of mine across the state had elected to simply allow them to go full remote. And I said, not here, not without a fight. And so we worked very hard to make it possible. And I understand the circumstances weren't ideal, and I totally appreciate the challenges and the criticism about the test. I had it too. But at the end of the day, I didn't want there to be an easy reason to tell our schools to go all remote. And so we fought very hard for that, and I'm doing the same thing for as many businesses as from my standpoint, I can justify keeping open based on the data. So restaurants and bars, certainly there are concerns, But until we have a reason to show that they need to close, I want to do everything we can to justify why they should be open.
Yeah, Dr. Michael Osterholm is an epidemiologist and a member of the advisory panel for the incoming Biden administration. And this week, Dr. Osterholm said that there is reason to be encouraged, that the vaccine news has been better than expected, that we can sort of see a light at the end of that tunnel. But he also said that while we are waiting for that to come, we are risking entering what he calls COVID hell. And to get out of that, Dr. Osterholm says, he said we could largely shut down the face-to-face interactions and physical businesses, essentially close physical businesses for about a month, use that pause as a bridge to a vaccine, drop caseloads dramatically. Do you think we're getting to that point, or do you think that if we sort of do what we're supposed to do, we're not going to have to shut physical buildings and physical interactions of businesses?
I still believe that we won't have to go to the extent of the lockdowns that we had undertaken earlier this year. I think Dr. Osterholm's point is valid, though, but it all depends upon how close that vaccine is, because, you know, the human factor is very real. And, you know, when people say, well, we did this before, we can do it again, that's true up to a point, because in March and April, we had a very different mindset about this pandemic. We had a lot of uncertainty, and that uncertainty bred fear. And now we have a little bit more certainty, still some uncertainty. And I think we have a different level of fear, if you want to call it that. But I think the level of patience, the tolerance, the appetite in our community to undergo that degree of lockdown, I think is thin. And so it's incumbent upon us as public officials and health leaders to really look at the data and justify. But at the same time, we also need the public to step up and do their part. And, you know, for all of the back and forth about orange, red, and yellow, frankly, if everybody wore their mask, kept their distance, and thought about their gatherings, we wouldn't need to have that debate. So, you know, we have to find a way to make some tough decisions, because we can't have our cake and eat it too. And if we don't make the easy decisions to wear our mask, keep our distance, and look at our gatherings, then we're going to have to entertain the hard decisions of how do we lock down. And I would much rather have the former than the latter.
Well, on the subject of the way, sort of the community responsibility that we all have in the outcome here, a friend of mine is a doctor, and she tells me pretty often, she says, look, we're still all getting COVID. Now, she doesn't mean that everybody we know is going to get COVID. What she means is there's still a lot of us who will end up with COVID, even if we do the right things. You know, if we're going into an office once in a while, if we go shop at a grocery store once in a while. She's essentially saying, if you get it, you or someone you know will probably get it. Don't blame yourself. Just be responsible and don't play a blame game. Now, having said that, she, and I think what you're saying, is that at large, the community does have a lot of hand in the outcome here. In other words, if the cases spike and we see closures, that's mostly on us collectively. Do you feel that way?
I do. I do agree with that, you know, because this is a human disease, and it spreads through human interaction. And as people, we can control our interactions, and nobody else can. So, you know, as government, as public officials, you know, we can set the boundaries. But at the end of the day, I can't count how many people are in your living room on Thanksgiving evening, and I don't want to. I want to believe that the public is smart enough and responsible enough to themselves, to their neighbors, to the rest of the community, to do the right thing. I think, you know, to rely on laws and regulations and enforcement, I think, is shirking our responsibility as citizens. I think we need to step up and do our part. And if we all do that, we won't need to enforce.
All right, last little bit from me, and I'll turn it over to the audience in our second half hour. And I want to look at a couple of things that I think are important for context here. Number one, for listeners, and there are multiple listeners who have emailed the program to say, hey, my whole family is getting together. We're just going to do it the Sweden way. Just so people know, Sweden is no longer doing it the Sweden way. Sweden announced a few days ago that their surging number of cases, infections, and deaths makes them change course, and the national leadership of Sweden has urged people to have gatherings of no more than 8 in Sweden. So even Sweden's not doing it Sweden's way, just so you know. And then the other thing that comes to mind for me is this, Dr. Mendoza. I look at the population of Monroe County, and interestingly enough, we are just about exactly the same population as the state of North Dakota. North Dakota had a very low caseloads and deaths for a long time, and now they have the highest rate of infections per thousand in the country. If they were a country on their own. They'd be one of the highest in the world. Their doctors are talking about an overwhelmed medical system. Their governor just got around to doing a mask mandate, and there's already been backlash for that. One of the sheriffs in North Dakota said, we're not even going to try to enforce it. It's not a real thing to us. We're just going to kind of keep educating. When I see mask mandates, it's the same to me as gathering mandates. I think no one's going to probably knock on your door and do a head count.
Right.
And for the most part, people aren't going to, you know, tap on your shoulder and put handcuffs on you for not wearing a mask. It sounds to me like a mechanism for government to say, these are the rules, but it's still up to you to follow them.
Yep. It's like seatbelt mandates or no jaywalking mandates. You know, it's both in our own best interest and in the best interest of our community that we all decide that we want to stop at a red light is important, not because we don't get hit, but so we don't hurt other people. You know, these are all, you know, examples of where, you know, we have to step up and do our part. And so I you know, nobody likes the word mandate. And in my estimation, we shouldn't need to. I guess that's my point.
Yeah, yeah. And so finally on that point, writing for The Atlantic, Ed Young has a new piece this week on the frustration that healthcare workers are feeling with the wider American public. And he writes that doctors and nurses are fearful that the medical system could become overwhelmed. We know in several states, multiple hospitals have already reached ICU capacity. And in the piece, he quotes Whitney Neville, who's a nurse based in Iowa. She told him, quote, "Nurses have been the most trusted profession for 18 years in a row in this country, which is now BS because no one is listening to us," end quote. Are you hearing any of that locally? Yep. Are you concerned about that?
Yep, I am. I am. And you know, our constant focus on hospitalizations and beds really misses the mark on what the true capacity is, which is the people, the nurses, the respiratory therapists, the doctors, the techs. They're not a fixed capacity. You know, they may be there in body, but they're no longer there in spirit like we were in March and April. You know, we are worn down, and there is burnout. And so, you know, while we have gotten better at caring for patients, and, you know, our ICU number now is actually as high as it ever was, but we're doing a better job keeping people alive because we've gotten better at this. But I don't want people to take advantage of that, quote, capacity. Because capacity isn't just beds, it's people. And these nurses, especially, who we do trust, they have every right to say, what is going on? Because if you really trusted us, then you would step up and do your part and wear your mask and not get sick or not get your relative sick. So we don't have to do what we do and be a hero in a hospital and take care of your loved one. It would be much better if we all helped the nurses by not only sending flowers and pizza, but by doing the right thing.
Could we see ICU capacity? I mean, could we see, let me put it this way. If the number of people who need to be in ICUs for this virus in our community doubles, what happens in the local hospitals?
Well, we're getting to capacity in some settings now. You know, if you look at our ICU numbers, it's getting up there. You know, what we'll have to do, it's not apples and oranges anymore, you know, comparing to earlier this year. You know, we'll have to find ways to get people out of the ICU faster. We'll have to find ways to get people out of the hospital faster. And if we can't, then we need to expand capacity and we need to dust off our plan to set up a field hospital and other units in the community. So we don't want to have to do that, but we're ready and prepared if we have to, and that's where we are.
Dr. Michael Mendoza is the Commissioner of Public Health for Monroe County. He's our guest for the hour, and he's got time to answer your questions after the other side of a break. Listeners, if you want to join the program, we've got a few phone lines open. I promise we will get through as many emails and phone calls as we can on this. The phone number is 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. Email us, connections@wxxi.org. We are right back with your calls and emails. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about tough conversations at Thanksgiving. There's always tough conversations at Thanksgiving. The election season was even more divisive than usual this time around, and some families are split about whether to get together at all because of the pandemic. So however you're getting together, across the table from one another, or via Zoom or phone, we'll talk about how to have those conversations next up. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's see how many questions we can get through from listeners before the end of the hour. Paul in Pavilion first. Go ahead, Paul.
Hello. I wish all public servants were as thoughtful as Dr. Mendoza. My question has to do with colored people having more risk of the disease. It's also well often stated that colored people have poorer health maintenance. A piece of information that has recently read was that some people are saying vitamin D is helpful for the disease. Have any retrospective studies been done on blood samples from people to see whether vitamin D status has any relevance to the outcomes of sick people? Thank you so much.
All right, Paul, thank you. Dr. Mendoza, go ahead.
Thank you, Paul, and thanks for your kind words. There's a lot of research ongoing, whether it's blood type, whether it's the role of vitamin D repletion, whether it's the roles of baseline vitamin D levels. There is promise in the vitamin D studies, but we're not yet at the point where we can necessarily make practice changes based on vitamin D levels or vitamin D repletion. So, you know, that is something that is an area of intense research across the globe at this point. When it comes to how this pandemic is affecting our communities, early in the pandemic, as we've reviewed, it primarily affected younger females, typically in their 20s, typically from communities of color, largely because of their having played a frontline role in healthcare and in other essential services. But that picture has evolved since March and April, and now we're looking at a very different pandemic. The current increases in cases have largely been in the suburbs, have not been among communities of color, have remained in the individuals in their 18 to 25-year-old range, but we're also seeing that in 50-year-olds and 45-year-olds. So, you know, the pandemic, the picture of the pandemic is changing, and so I think it underscores the fact that this entire community has to get on board with this because we don't want to see this disproportionately impacting anybody, not least of which are most vulnerable, namely those in nursing homes and long-term care facilities. So I think we have to keep our foot on the gas when it comes to our attention on underserved communities, but this is not just a problem of underserved communities. This is the entire community, and we have to all get on board.
Kathy in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Kathy.
Yes, two questions. One is, I thought the state had a mandate that if we maintained over 40% cases for over 10 days, that we would automatically be put into the orange category. Is that true, and why aren't we?
Thanks for your question, Kathy. That's a common question that we're getting now. You know, if the rules had been allowed to proceed to the letter, I think tomorrow we would have been officially orange. And, you know, back on Sunday or over the weekend, I was looking ahead to this week, and at that point, it didn't look like we had any other direction but to head toward orange. So, you know, we've been working with the governor's office to try to find ways to relook at some of those, particularly in light of what we had anticipated that we would learn in the schools. And so, thankfully, the numbers are starting to improve, and so we're not on track at this point to be orange today or tomorrow. But we need to keep vigilant because it doesn't take long for that seven-day trend to go back the other direction. So, but I will say that the governor's office and the state have been very open to learning from what we're developing here in terms of knowledge. And, you know, nobody's been through the process of having to reopen again. And so I think that to the extent that we can inform that practice, we can serve as leaders for how to do this across the state.
All right, two different questions from listeners about where they can go safely. Dave wants to know, how safe is it to go to the dentist during their times? Another listener wants to know, Deborah, how safe can I feel spending an hour meeting with a friend in one of our local coffee shops?
Well, so, you know, risk is a two-sided sword. There's the risk presented by the interaction, and then there's the risk that you're willing to take. And I think the risk presented by the action can be managed, can be understood, and can be reduced. But the other side of the coin, which is how much risk you're willing to take, is a very personal decision. So when it comes to the dental offices, I can tell you they work very hard to do everything they can to minimize the risk. That being said, a dentist office is among the higher risk interactions between dental offices and optometrists and ophthalmologists. You know, being in close contact, literally less than a foot, for prolonged periods of time, that is the highest, you know, among the highest risks. So they've taken all sorts of precautions, but, you know, the other side of this is, what risk are you willing to take? If you have emergent dental work that has to be done, well, then you are probably more likely to tolerate more risk. If you're looking at a routine cleaning that you can defer another 6 months, then you might say, it's okay to take a pass. So, you know, from the side of the dental offices, they've done everything they can, but I think, to your point, you also have to decide how much risk you're willing to take. And then as far as coffee shops go, again, it's the same idea. You know, the more you can decrease the length of the interaction, the more you can increase your distance. You know, you're probably not going to be wearing your mask while at a coffee shop, but if you're just talking, maybe you might consider it. But again, it comes down to risk and benefit. You know, you have to be thinking both about, you know, the coffee shops can only do so much. You know, outdoor coffee is probably not in the cards anymore. So, you know, you have to ask yourself, you know, what is the risk and benefit for you?
Okay, Ingrid writes from Fairport saying, you mentioned, Dr. Mendoza, that trading food for Thanksgiving via non-contact, and my understanding is there's still relatively little risk via food transmission, but has anything changed? Is that correct? That's from Ingrid.
That's a good question, Ingrid. So, contrary to, you know, popular language, we don't actually inhale our food. And it turns out that to get this virus, you actually have to inhale it. So food turns out to be actually quite safe, you know, particularly if you're not sharing utensils. But, you know, sharing meals that were prepared from one household to the other, you know, we don't think that you can contract this virus through through consumption by eating. It's got to literally be inhaled.
Okay. Boy, oh, boy. There's so many. Paul says... Dr. Mendoza, given that Governor Cuomo has stated that New York State will not allow distribution of a vaccine until the state has independently reviewed the data on safety and effectiveness, what is known about how New York will conduct that independent review and how long it might take to complete before we can start receiving and using the vaccine here? What do we know about that, Dr. Mendoza?
Well, I can tell you that the state health department is going to lead the way in terms of their assessment of the vaccine's efficacy and safety record and so forth. And frankly, I'm going to do the same thing here. You know, I have a background in peer review and in the medical literature and critical appraisal of medical studies, and I'm going to do the same thing because I want to have that level of confidence before I put, my green light behind it, if you will. So, you know, this isn't a political process. This is a scientific process. And, you know, I want scientists who are versed in virology and immunology to make these assessments. And so it will happen at the state level. It will happen here. The timing of all that is really changing. You know, I think, you know, probably 2 or 3 months ago, I was probably saying that we weren't going to see this until, you know, the spring. And now I think we'll probably see something this winter. So, you know, the horizon seems to be shortening. But I do think that on the flip side of things, the general public will probably not have access to the vaccine for at least the spring or summer. Because if you think about it, you know, this vaccine, everything currently is pointing toward it being a two-vaccine series separated by 28 days. So, you know, depending on how many people get that, decide to get the vaccine here in Monroe County, it'll be twice that many shots that we need to figure out as a community how to distribute. So it's gonna be a process. So
okay.
It'll be a while.
Okay. Now, just knowing that a lot will still change, tell me if I'm right when I say I think I have read that when vaccines start to be distributed, it will be up to individual states on how to prioritize who gets them. In other words, there won't be a sort of a national top-down plan on here's first in line, here's next. States will get a certain allocation and will make their own decisions on where they go and whom to whom. Is that correct?
I would be surprised if every state is left to their own devices.
Okay.
You know, this won't be the first time that we've had to figure out, you know, a priority for a treatment or a vaccine. There won't be any surprises. Healthcare workers, first responders, people with chronic medical illnesses, people with, you know, suppressed immune systems, that those individuals will be toward the top. And how we prioritize, how we implement, you know, I think those details may be left up to the states. But I think the general science of it, you know, there's no reason to think that, you know, a first responder in North Dakota is going to be any different than a first responder in New York State.
Okay. Last question on vaccines, and I'll get back to our listeners. Are you concerned at all that if there are sore arms or if there are even mild symptoms that sometimes come with vaccines, that those could be sort of anecdotalized and overreported and made to convince the public that this is not safe?
I anticipate that. Sadly, I anticipate that, you know, these small, and they're going to happen. There's no way you can inject something into millions of people's arms and not have a mild reaction at some point. So I would frankly plan for that, because I just think it's inevitable. And my only hope is that the better part of reason will prevail, and that we'll look at the science and we'll look at the big picture from reliable sources, and hope that the public, as it has to date, frankly, made the right choices based on reliable information.
Tracy writes to say, "Hi, Evan and Dr. Mendoza. I'm wondering about people that have had COVID-19. What does the data tell us as to how long they have immunity? And more importantly, is there evidence that they cannot transmit the virus during this immunity phase? Any other information you provide would be helpful." Tracy, let me just give you one little bit from me, and then I'll kick it over to Dr. Mendoza. As a journalist, it's been very difficult to sort of follow this question because I don't have medical training. And I think too often we've seen headlines like, oh, you know, a person in Hong Kong gets a second infection, and everybody assumes then, oh, there's no immunity. Well, I've tried to sort of stay steady with assuming that this virus will behave like most other viruses, in which there will be some immunity. We don't know how long. The latest I've read, though, and Dr. Mendoza may be much more privy to this than I am, is that at least with some of the vaccine hope and maybe with natural infection, that the immunity may be longer and more durable than some of the initial fears, but I don't know. So, Dr. Mendoza, can you take it from there?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, I've read probably some of the same studies, and I am beginning to think that it will be longer than we had thought it would be. That meaning the immunity from either the natural infection or from what will come from a vaccine. But the studies are ongoing. You know, I'm very conservative when it comes to making predictions, and I don't want to make any predictions until we have good science behind it. So I think the trend at this point is toward longer immunity, not less. Yes, there are examples here in Monroe County where we're wondering if people actually got reinfected or whether it was a persistent infection from the initial one. You know, so there's a lot that we're still trying to sort out. But when you look at the national data and some of the studies that are coming out from the researchers across the globe, I think there's good reason to be hopeful that the vaccine will offer more extended immunity than initially predicted.
And if you have immunity, the idea is then that you're not going to pick up COVID again and spread it, right?
That's the thought. Now, you know, the big question is, to what extent does COVID, the virus that causes COVID-19, to what extent does it mutate? You know, that is another question that is being researched. And to the best of our knowledge, the SARS-CoV-2 virus does mutate, but it's a slow mutator. So any mutations that result from this are likely to be less virulent than the initial strain. And so that, from a, you know, public standpoint, means that, you know, rapid mutations, it's unlikely to behave like seasonal flu,
yeah,
is the bottom line.
And Ruth asked, are participants in vaccine trials required to wear face masks and maintain social distancing? Yes, Ruth, absolutely, because they may have just a placebo, right, Dr. Mendoza?
Right, absolutely. And so it's universal precautions until proven otherwise. You know, the individuals who've gotten this vaccine don't know if they got the vaccine being studied or placebo. So absolutely, they need to take precautions.
One of our listeners wants to know, asked to remain anonymous, how do you address continual attacks from anti-mask and virus conspiracy theorists that continually spread misinformation and anti-science rhetoric?
I listen to them. I do. And it is a little trying at times. But I do care about how everybody thinks. I want to understand the opposing viewpoints to what I have to say, because it helps me to reaffirm where I come from my scientific background, and it also helps me to perhaps think about how I can reach out to people who differ. And I think at the end of the day, you know, it's my job to do both. And so while challenging, I do read a lot of that. I do take it to heart, and I want to find a way to find common ground, because that is ultimately how we're going to get our way through this.
Yeah, good stuff. Couldn't agree more from my perspective. Jeff wants to know, are retail establishments in Monroe County mandated to inform the health department about employees testing positive, like Wegmans or Walmart or Tops, and does the health department release these specific places to the public?
Are they mandated? I don't believe they're mandated, but short of that, my goodness, I wish you will call us, because we've had examples of individuals who were positive, who went to work and infected other people, and that is a risk to the public. And short of any law that mandates that, I can tell you it is exceedingly unwise to knowingly allow an employee who is ill to be coming to work. If you're a restaurant and we permit you, we will absolutely address that. But for stores and businesses, you know, the health department, generally speaking, doesn't have authority over how they operate. So, again, we're relying on you as members of our community to do the right thing, because at the end of the day, a store that is unsafe will be less desirable to customers. And that's the position I think we all need to take.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. Hey, I think I cut Kathy's call early last time. Let me bring her back in, and she's going to follow up now. Go ahead, Kathy.
I'm sorry. I was cut off. The quick question is enforcement. And one example, I'm concerned that there's no fines or anything for people other than restaurants and institutions. Like, for example, the new skate park downtown.
Mm-hmm.
It's been reported repeatedly that the kids are not wearing masks. Why are they being allowed to skate, and who is enforcing the rules?
So we've looked into the skate park downtown, and I'll say that the one reassuring feature of the skate park downtown is that it's outdoors. And I'll tell you that to date we haven't seen any cases attributable to the skate park, much like we haven't seen cases attributable to any of the large outdoor gatherings that we've seen in our community dating back to April. So I am reassured by that, but I do think the question of enforcement is important, particularly as we go indoors. Because you can imagine a gathering of the same size and the same quality indoors. And, yes, we will enforce. And there, you know, I wish we didn't have to. I wish we didn't have to. But if we do and we have, we will enforce.
Okay. Let me get Barbara in Brighton on the phone next. Go ahead, Barbara.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that although I totally appreciate all angles of it, I think everybody's dancing around. And instead of dealing with mandates, I think we should have manslaughter. And I am dead serious. I think if people are out there at this stage of the game, when we know perfectly well that you could be killing off other people, I think police should arrest them, charge them with manslaughter, and take them away. And that's all I have to say.
All right, Barbara, thank you. Dr. Mendoza?
Yeah, there are strong feelings on both sides of this. I can totally understand where you're coming from, and I hear your frustration. But I do think that we've got to find a way to have common ground on this one. And for every individual like yourself, there's somebody on the other side of the fence who feels as passionately in the other direction. And at the end of the day, we've got to find a way to reconcile our differences and think about this as a community.
Kathy in Chilai says, Dr. Mendoza, I see how careful the pro sports teams are being, keeping players in bubbles, daily testing, etc. And then I watched on news channels recently, in the past few days, clips of high school sports. There was a high school girls' soccer game. The girls had their masks on while playing, but with all the running, it's obvious they're breathing heavily. The boys had their masks down around their necks while playing. High fives, hugs after good plays, pileups on the ground when people tripped. I realize that New York State has mandated testing 20% of each school each week due to our yellow status, but what about high school sports? Are we comfortable with what they are doing?
I think high school sports represent a somewhat different denominator than the schools themselves. The kinds of interactions that we have on the field, and more importantly, the kinds of interactions that we have on the sidelines and before and after the games, represent a different risk than what we're seeing in the traditional classroom setting. So I am still a bit cautious when it comes to school sports, interscholastic sports, traveling sports, because particularly as we go indoors, you know, there have been cases attributed to school sports teams. You know, whether it was on the field or off the field is still somewhat unclear, but I'm leaning toward, you know, we don't know. And it's quite possible that we've had on-field transmission. And that's outdoors. So yeah, as we go indoors, I think we are still following this very, very closely.
Don says, can you please explain the requirement that schools test a different 20% each week? Does that mean 100% need to be tested by week 5? And what happens for schools that can't get 100% to consent to test?
Well, so that is a moving target to some degree. We just learned over the weekend that if after 2 weeks, you test 20% of that total denominator, if the ensuing rate is lower than the community rate, then we do not have to continue testing. So that 20%, it had been per week, and now it's 20% over the first 2 weeks. So that's the first change. And the second point I want to make about that 20% is that we calculate the 20% off of a denominator of people who are consenting. So for those who wish to opt out, in my view, they shouldn't be counted in that 20%. And so far, I think that makes sense, because in all of the school districts that I'm aware of, the number of people who have opted out has not been a substantial number of people. So I think we can fully meet the spirit of the law by calculating that 20% off of the parents and staff who decide they wish to consent.
Okay. Well, a lot of listeners writing in to saying you're a calming voice of reason here, and I appreciate the hour because I know we covered a lot of ground. It is a very changing landscape out there, and like you said, Dr. Mendoza, a lot of this is still in our hands, isn't it?
Indeed, indeed. Well, thank you again for the opportunity to get this word out there. And at the end of the day, I think we're all in this together, and I'm very grateful for our community.
Get some sleep sometimes.
Will do. Will do.
Dr. Mendoza and his colleagues are doing such important and, frankly, heroic work, and we're grateful for his time. He's the Commissioner of Public Health in Monroe County. And listeners, if we didn't have time to get your calls and questions, we'll do our best to continue with him and his colleagues in the weeks to come. Such an important time for our community in this pandemic. We've got more connections coming up.